From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Thirty-one states have the death penalty, including New Hampshire. But in recent years, the Granite State has come close several times to repealing capital punishment. And this year, the House and Senate have both voted to abolish the death penalty by sizable, although not veto-proof margins. Meanwhile, Governor Sununu has promised to veto this measure, saying he stands with crime victims, members of law enforcement, and advocates for justice. Today in The Exchange, what's changed and what hasn't in the Granite State's long death penalty debate? And later on, more headlines about sexual misconduct at St. Paul's School. These allegations going back decades. Let's get your comments in now about the death penalty repeal. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests in studio. Chuck Douglas is here, trial lawyer, former congressman, former New Hampshire Supreme Court justice. He testified against repeal of the death penalty. And Chuck Douglas, good to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning. Glad to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Avard. He's prime sponsor of the bill to repeal the death penalty. He's been a state senator representing District 12, which includes Nashua, since 2015. And Senator Avard, good to see you. Thank you also for being here.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
And also with us, Ethan DeWitt, Concord Monitor State House reporter, who's done extensive reporting on the death penalty in the Granite State. And Ethan, thank you for helping us out.
Happy to be here.
Well, and Ethan, how surprising is this pretty solid vote in both houses in favor of death penalty repeal? 223 to 116 in the House, 14 to 10 in the Senate.
Sure. So I guess in the short term, not too surprising, this bill came out of the gate with 13 sponsors in the House, in the Senate, which meant that they had the votes to pass it. And in a lot of ways, the kind of the trajectory of this, there's been a lot of attempts over the years. The trajectory of this particular attempt was sort of known from the beginning. In January, they had the votes. They had the Senate had the votes. And in February, the governor vowed to veto it. So everyone was sort of on the same track. But the trend is sort of new. It's there's been votes. There was a vote in 2009, in 2014. Both times the Senate deadlocked. The last time both chambers passed this was in 2000. So this is a different step, and it's difficult to determine whether this is how much this is a shift, because there are a lot of senators are new since the last time they voted. I looked, and there's only about 9 senators that were there in 2014. But it does represent sort of a gradual shift in that you see in state houses across the country.
And in 2000, that's the example that's been famously used. Both the House and Senate again passed repeal, but then Governor Jeanne Shaheen vetoed it. So we're kind of in that same situation today.
We are, although we have a significant difference between 2000 in that we have a person on death row in our state, which was not the case when then Governor Jeanne Shaheen vetoed then. And that has, in over the past 3 times this has come up in the legislature, that has colored the debate to a large extent.
Okay, and we should definitely talk a little bit more about that, because you're right, that's a big difference from 2000. Chuck Douglas, were you surprised by these votes in the House and Senate?
The Senate, no. The House, yes. I thought the House would have a stronger vote against repeal. The Senate, obviously, with 13 sponsors, was fairly obvious how that was going to go. So we'll just have to see. But I believe that it will be, because it's a Senate bill, it'll start in the Senate and the veto will be sustained.
And as someone who is against repeal,
right,
how did you feel about some of the arguments that were coming up this time around?
Well, I guess I've been at it for a long time. 1974, I was helping to draft the current law with Warren Rudman, who was Attorney General. I was legal counsel to the governor. The Supreme Court of the United States had struck down a number of death penalty statutes. We had to rewrite ours, and we rewrote it in a very narrow way, basically trying to protect civil society, judges, police, prison guards, people who represent the state and are on the front lines, murder for hire. So we don't have a broad death penalty for every 7-Eleven robbery that goes bad. It's a very tight one, And I still support it wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and I'm glad you raised that, because that's a description that often comes up. We have a narrow statute. We don't overuse it. We don't abuse it. It's only assigned, if I could use that verb, in very specific cases. How about you, Kevin Avard? How have your feelings about the death penalty changed over time?
Very good question. It's been a long journey for me, because I've been a very strong advocate for the death penalty majority of my life. You asked the question earlier, what's changed? I have changed. My perspective has changed. And there are three points that go to that: faith and conscience, human error, potential human error, and the financial burdens that it places on society. And getting to the faith and conscience, it's really interesting how a number of lenses, eyeballs, have been viewing this. And we see the full spectrum from far left, if you will, to far right, actually focusing on this issue and coming together in agreement. As you can see, we have 13 co-sponsors from the Senate, which, you know, we have everything from Martha Fuller Clark to Senator Bob Gaida.
And so spanning from quite liberal to quite conservative.
And when you see such a focus of such diverse backgrounds coming together, you really shouldn't ignore that. It's not a good thing. But with the change that happened in me, I was asked to interview a gentleman by the name of Randy Seidel. He was on death row for 17 plus years, not in the state of New Hampshire, but in another state. And I told him flat out, before I even started the interview, you know, I'm pro-death penalty. And as he's talking, I'm looking inside, saying, look, have I really evaluated this properly? Have I? There was a really conflict in me, because I really wanted to hang on to my roots, my badge, if you will. I'm this conservative Republican, very staunch, you know, for the justice system and making sure that it's held. But as I evaluated his testimony, I had to step back and take a look inside and reevaluate why I'm here.
So what was it that he said that turned you around?
Well, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he basically was processed in a system that was hell-bent on making sure that he got prosecuted regardless of whether he was guilty or not. And this, I believe this was in the state of Illinois, where he was basically on death row for a long period of time for a capital crime. It cost the state $17 million to process him. And come to find out, somebody actually believed in him and did some investigating and found that there was some exculpatory evidence that was not brought forward.
So he was innocent.
He was innocent. And that's how I was able to interview him. But being on death row wrongfully it's a scary thing. And I think as I step back, I started listening to other testimony. Well, just in our neighboring state, we had 4,000 cases of DNA that was tampered with.
Is that Massachusetts?
In Massachusetts, yes. And it causes you great pause. Well, if that can happen there, can you guarantee 100% that it won't happen in New Hampshire? And I didn't get a positive on that. So human error is part of the factor. And but listening to Randy and two other individuals that were on death row troubled me, that were exonerated. Come to find out, we have over 169 people nationwide that have been exonerated, that were on death row. And it shows that it can happen. Can it happen in New Hampshire? I think we have the history that shows that it did happen in New Hampshire, that somebody was wrongfully placed on death row from a former attorney general. So can it happen? Yeah.
And I've heard stories of other people feeling the same way, that they hear about the Innocence Project, I think it was called, started in mm-hmm. Illinois, mm-hmm. led to some exonerations, as you said, Senator Avard. And so this has become an argument. Chuck Douglas, I wonder what you think, that
you
can make a mistake.
You can. I'm not going to say no one has ever been wrongfully convicted of anything anywhere, but the major difference between an Illinois or a Texas is, in New Hampshire, any murder case is handled by the Attorney General's office. And our attorneys general are appointed, not elected. So they do not have to worry about the press or public creating a storm of you've got to hang this guy. That's the first major difference. Second, we don't have a history of racial disproportionality in use of the death penalty. I think until Michael Addison, and Kevin may be able to correct me, everyone that has been executed in New Hampshire has been white.
And that was, what, the last execution was, what, 70, 80 years ago?
But I'm talking for 200 years, Laura. In other words, it is not as if 9 out of 10 people hung in New Hampshire were black, because we don't have that history. That, unfortunately, is a factor concerning the courts in states where you had slavery and you had a different culture. When you look at that and you look at the fact that the Concord Monitor headline from 10 years ago was very clear, Addison killed Briggs. And that was the opening argument by Addison's lawyer, Dave Rothstein, when he admitted to the jury, we are not here to debate whether Michael Addison killed Officer Briggs.
So it's clear,
it was crystal clear. So you could do 400 DNA tests and it wouldn't make any difference. And so I think we have to look, and where I disagree with Kevin is we aren't the other states. We are New Hampshire. We have unarmed prison guards dealing with inmates who are doing life without parole. There is no disincentive to killing them if the only thing you get is another life without parole sentence. And so I think for New Hampshire, it is wrong to repeal the death penalty and strip our police, our law enforcement, our judges, our prison guards of that protection. And the folks that want to repeal it want to repeal all of it. And I think they go way too far. And it's going to be – they're going to regret it when that first incident happens in one of our prisons. And I just think that's why I have no hesitation in saying our narrow law works.
Well, I have so many more questions for all of you. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Today in Exchange, rethinking the death penalty. For the first time in almost a decade, lawmakers in both chambers have sent a death penalty repeal to the governor's desk. Governor Sununu says he will veto this, but we're taking some time. We're looking at how our death penalty law is set up now and some of the changing politics around this issue. And again, let's get your questions and comments in about this latest repeal effort. How do you feel about it? 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Ethan, I did want to ask you, we heard from Senator Avard. He was moved by the testimony of someone who was on death row, later exonerated. How much did you hear about this in the hearings on this death penalty repeal?
This came up a lot. And I think that if it's indicative of any kind of shift, you can see it there. If you're looking to see why the votes went the way they did, a lot of people have met with exonerees. A lot of people mentioned the Massachusetts case, the DNA examples in hearings. So this was, it appeared to be for those who changed their votes, a major factor.
You also wrote, Ethan, in one of your stories that New Hampshire's death penalty is, for now, as you put it, functionally non-existent. What does that mean?
Sure. So the point of the story was kind of to take a look at how prepared New Hampshire would be to carry out an execution. We have one person on death row, but he's going through federal appeals. Those appeals have not been exhausted yet. Those appeals, all parties expect to take years. But if and when those appeals are exhausted, can we actually do it? And the short answer is no. We are lacking critical infrastructure on about three different fronts. First of all, we don't have any drugs to administer lethal injection. We don't have a facility in which to administer those drugs. And we don't have any rules or protocols in place for how those drugs are to be administered and kind of how the whole process needs to work. It's set out in in guidelines and statute, but it's sort of deferred to the Department of Corrections commissioner to figure out what those rules are. From the officials I've talked to, nobody has any plans right now of how to do that.
Well, and in fact, as you were reporting, I got kind of a vibe, Ethan, that you were having a hard time getting this information from Department of Corrections or the Attorney General. It seemed like nobody really wanted to give you a lot of detail.
Sure. It took a lot of sort of wheedling. And once you finally did get an answer, I eventually heard from the Attorney General, we do not have a plan. I think she said, I don't think there is a specific plan at this point. That was the Deputy Attorney General. The governor, I asked questions on kind of what might be in the works. The governor declined to answer those questions. So it's really sort of up in the air. It seems that everybody, according to the Deputy Attorney General, they're just sort of taking a wait-and-see approach. They're going to wait until the appeals get closer to finishing. But there is some concern that, the state won't have enough in place to properly carry any of this out.
Well, again, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, here's an email that came in from Dennis in Barrington, who says, capital punishment has one useful purpose, and that is to be used by politicians who feel a need to protect themselves from potential attacks of being soft on crime. Dennis says there's a long list of ethical reasons to abandon capital punishment, but in addition to ethics, there are practical considerations that it doesn't act as a deterrent and ends up costing taxpayers more than life without parole. Dennis says it's time that New Hampshire join other states and the majority of countries in the developed world and move beyond state-sanctioned killing. I guess I'll go to you first, Chuck Douglas, but I want to hear from you too, Senator Avard. Is the death penalty a deterrent to crime?
I believe it is. There have been studies both ways on it, and like a lot of things, you can debate it back and forth. But as a practical matter, if you just look at the Parkland shooter, I've got the story from his, the guy that killed the 19 folks at the high school.
17, yeah.
17. Suddenly, when it's his life on the line, he had said, I will plead guilty to life without parole, but I want a trial if the death penalty's on the table. That's just typical of the kind of mindset we're dealing with. I believe in deterrence. I think people are used to certain vigorous enforcement of the law, let's say a speed trap. That deters you from speeding if you know it will be enforced. And part of the problem with the death penalty is with 15 years of appeals, it does not have the same impact that it would if it was only a 2 or 3 year delay, and that's part of the argument that folks on the other side use. But of course, their goal is to drag it out as long as they can. What do you do with someone like the guy that killed three people in Conway? March 19, Mike Woodbury, in prison in Florida, 5 sentences of life without parole, and he kills an inmate. Now they're going to say we need the death penalty for him because he was not, unfortunately, convinced that life without parole was that big a deal. When you're doing 5 life without paroles, a 6th doesn't matter.
Well, Senator Avard, I'll get your thoughts on that after a short break. And also the idea that Governor Sununu has put forward that basically New Hampshire's death penalty statute shows law enforcement that we've got their backs, we recognize the danger that they're in every day. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also keep taking your comments. So send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, an update on New Hampshire's long-standing death penalty debate and the recent vote in both houses to repeal it. Later in our show, the latest allegations of sexual misconduct at St. Paul's School, these charges going back many decades. Send us your email now on the death penalty issue, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Senator Kevin Avard, prime sponsor of the bill to repeal the death penalty. He represents District 12, which includes Nashua. Also with us, Ethan DeWitt, Concord Monitor State House reporter, who's done a lot of reporting on this issue. And Chuck Douglas, trial lawyer, former congressman, former state Supreme Court Justice. Chuck Douglas has testified against repeal of the death penalty. One more time, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Senator Avard, I did want to ask you about a big argument that has come up. Chuck's made it this morning, the governor has made it, and that is New Hampshire's very carefully, narrowly drawn statute does show law enforcement, corrections officers, that we've got their backs, that we recognize the danger they put themselves in every day, and that the death penalty sort of enhances their safety a bit more. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I would have to take issue with that. I mean, I support our police officers, and I think over the last few years they've gone through just a myriad of issues where people are attacking them, and I my heart goes out to them. However, when you consider the Addison case, that did not stop him from killing the officer.
Was not a deterrent.
It was
for
not
him
a deterrent.
Killing Officer Briggs.
Officer Briggs and former Attorney General Phil McLaughlin, who was definitely a pro death penalty individual at one point, also testified against the death penalty, and pointing out the deterrent factor. Quote: He says, "You can't point to any sustainable facts that it works." These are not my words. These are his words. And you know, he had a statement which we both came to the same conclusion, that it wasn't an event, but it was a process that brought him to this conclusion. And he goes through a myriad of testimony in an article where he had a big turnaround.
Have you talked to the governor about this?
I did talk to him, and you know, I have to respect everybody's perspective on this. This is like I said in the beginning, a matter of faith and conscience. And I was definitely where he is, and I have absolute respect for that. And I understand where they're coming from. You cannot convince somebody against their will, for they will be of the same opinion still. This has to be something that comes inward, and you have to see it for yourself. And I've had that journey.
How has the fact that there is someone on death row, Michael Addison, we've touched on this, but I want to hit it a little harder. Ethan, I'll turn to you first. How has that affected this discussion right now?
Sure. So as for all the debate that I've seen, it's been something that kind of everybody's agreed upon. Those who want repeal say that they don't want any repeal efforts, by and large, to affect his case. And the question that then comes up, and that's come up in debates and hearings, is how you can actually ensure that that's so. There has been a history of other states who have repealed death penalty or capital punishment and had their death row inmates exonerated later, or not exonerated, sorry, but had their sentences commuted down to life without parole. And so there is that the supporters say that the language has been designed to be forward looking so that it would affect future convictions. And there's uncertainty around there, and there's debate. And so whenever it comes up, it either comes up sort of emotionally as a case for keeping the penalty, or it comes up in the context of people who support repealing it, saying that this case is important, but we need to look forward.
Yeah. So, and I believe Governor Hassan had the same position, that she was in favor of repeal, but she said, you know, if it were repealed, we wouldn't touch the Addison case. But I wonder if you find that convincing,
no,
Chuck Douglas.
No, you can't repeal it and keep Addison in the status he's in.
Because then that gives his team another legal argument.
Well, what's happened is Connecticut is the last New England state before New Hampshire to take up this issue. State v. Santiago in the Connecticut Supreme Court 3 years ago, they said once the legislature has made the decision that the death penalty is no longer in effect, we will retroactively apply that, and every other state that has done it retroactively apply it to those on death row. So if you vote to repeal, you are voting to give Addison a sentence of life without parole. And anyone who thinks otherwise, I think, is misinformed. The other problem with repeal is if the greatest penalty for killing an officer is life without parole, the way to avoid trial is to cut a deal for life with parole, because you always have to have some carrot that you can offer an accused. If you don't want to go through a six-week trial, you don't want to spend life in prison forever, then cut a deal and plead to life. And so you keep watering down the deterrent effect. Is everyone going to be deterred? Of course not. And Kevin's right. Addison did shoot a police officer. But there are others who failed to pull the trigger in settings with police officers because they don't want to die. And they have been interviewed and said, yeah, at the last minute I said, oh, you're a cop. And that's when I put the gun down. If you take that off the table, I think it's making law enforcement and prison guards who don't even have mace, they don't even have a baton, they're walking around with as much equipment as you are, Laura, and many of them are female, with 50 or 60 convicted felons. That has to be on the books to protect them, and I think it's irresponsible to take that protection away.
Well, and what you said shines a light for people who aren't within the legal system, as you've been for so long, that the idea that it's good to have more options, and then you can kind of work with those more options. If you take this option off the table, then your possibilities are more limited.
That's why the Parkland shooter said a couple of weeks ago, I'll plead guilty, but I don't want the death penalty.
Senator Averett, what do you think about that?
I'll take a little bit of issue. I know that this whole plea thing is important, but we had a situation, I believe it was, Attorney General Phil McLaughlin, who explains that they garnished a false confession in a death penalty case. And it wasn't until some DNA came up that it proved that the confession was basically what was wrong.
I think I remember the case you're talking about, a terrible story about a little six-year-old girl. Everybody maybe thought it was the mom's boyfriend. He looked a little sketchy, right? And he was accused, and everybody thought it was him. And then, oops, no, it wasn't.
Right. And she was basically said to her that you'll be part of the death penalty if we're going to convict you of that if you don't point the finger.
But and I don't think a formal charge had actually been brought with the death penalty. I don't believe that had gone that far.
It was going down that track, though,
wasn't
it? It
was headed there. I will agree with you, but there had not been an indictment by a grand jury, as I recall it. And again, I know there was testimony on that at the hearing, as you know.
I agree, and I totally concede that point. However, the perception on the person who was pointing the finger, you know, brought great trauma to somebody who was innocent.
Does your bill, Senator Avard, exempt Michael Addison from this death penalty repeal? Because I've heard others besides Chuck say, yeah, right, if this were repealed, you know, his lawyers would just have another tool to get him off death row.
Well, the entire intent, it doesn't say that in the language. The entire intent is to move forward from this point on, and it in my humble opinion, it wasn't. I'm not an attorney. I don't play one on TV.
Or the radio.
But it was to move forward and it was to move forward from Addison forward, not including Addison. So,
let's read another email. And this is to you, Ethan. Fred asks, Ethan, what does the governor get for his opposition? Votes, campaign funds, some other quid pro quo? Fred, thanks for the email.
I can't read into his mind, but I would assume that in a campaign year, an election year, it's less what he gets from vetoing than what he would get if he didn't veto, if he allowed this repeal to go ahead. I think that's really politically tricky. I think the Addison case makes it difficult. It's easier for a lawmaker to be one of a majority voting for this, but for a governor to allow it to go forward, if the Addison case unraveled going forward, I think that would be a political liability for him in the state. So that's probably One of the factors in his statement in February when he was talking about this, he also mentioned the rights of crime victims. This was around the same time as he was promoting Marcy's Law, and so we kind of tied that together. But again, it's hard to know exactly the any motivations, but that could be a political motivation.
Well, I'd take exception to that because I believe during the campaign, before he was even governor, he made it clear when asked, it wasn't like a major issue for Chris Sununu, but he said, no, I would support continuing the death penalty. So it's not like, oh, I'm against it, but now that I'm governor, I'm for it. That it's not that at all.
He's always felt that way, as did Gene Shaheen and I believe
right.
John Lynch.
And a woman named Hillary Clinton also said that she opposes broad use of the death penalty, but there are some people so evil and their acts so repugnant, such as Dylann Roof, who killed 9 people in a black church and said, I'm not sorry for what I did. Those people deserve the death penalty, in my opinion. They are evil. They are, if they're going to repent and find God, they can do that on their own time as best they can. But some people are so evil, whether it's Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, society needs to have a message for those people.
You know, Ethan mentioned victims, and I'm glad you did, Ethan, because there's been considerable debate over whether the death penalty helps victims feel justice has been done or whether it actually prevents healing. Ethan, to you, but then I want to hear from you other gentlemen as well. How much did victims chime in on this discussion at the State House? I mean, we've just had a lot of attention on victims and how they feel and victims' rights with Marcy's Law. Were they active in this particular discussion?
Well, one of them has been prominent for decades, Representative Rennie Cushing.
Right.
And he had in hearings and on the House floor, he cited his personal example. He had a family member killed.
His father was murdered. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there was not the death penalty in that case, and he sort of has used that as an example in his the way he sees it, using his own experience. He found that he found other ways to be able to kind of move on as a victim and be able to heal that didn't involve capital punishment, and so he's been at the forefront of kind of every debate when it comes to victims as a representative himself.
Right. And, you know, Senator Avard, I mean, how much can we really say definitively whether the death penalty helps or hurts victims? I mean, everyone's so different. Everybody grieves differently. I don't wonder if we can really even talk about that.
Again, it's really an individual matter of conscience and faith. If somebody wants to take that path of forgiveness or vengeance, that's really an individual situation. And I wanted to get back a little bit to the governor, because as I talked to him, I mean, I looked into his eyes. I read people. I look, and I know that he sincerely believes this. And not for political purposes.
Getting back to Fred's email,
yeah,
what does he get out of this?
I think he has a conscience that he has to deal with. And I think unless you've come to the same conclusion on your own, to judge somebody's motivations is a dangerous path, and I don't think it's fair, because I really think he believes it. During the governor's race, he did announce that, and I think Commissioner Edelblut said he was on the opposite side of that. And, of course, the people voted for Governor Sununu. And it's not that I want him to have a pass. I think every individual, whether it's this case or talking about the victims and having the ability to forgive or say, no, you know what, I need this resolve.
Let's take another call, and this is Jason in Pembroke. Hi, Jason. Thanks for being on our conversation today. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you all so much. My name is Jason Wells. I'm the executive director of the New Hampshire Council of Churches. And one place where our member churches are unanimous is in support of death penalty repeal. We are people of belief that life is sacred in a way that we cannot intentionally take. And further, to address Mr. Douglas's point, that there's no such thing as a human life that is too evil to live. I'm curious to ask a question for Mr. Douglas. On the one hand, I heard him in the program say that he praised New Hampshire's death penalty statute for being narrow and limited. But on the other hand, I've heard him say just now that he advocates applying that to people who commit hate crimes, that he has, in other places in New Hampshire's recent past, we just heard the president try to expand and broaden that to drug dealers, as well as trying to expand it at another time to people who commit crimes in home invasions.
Well, yes, and I remember when that debate came up actually in 2010 after a horrifying home invasion murder and almost murder. The mother was murdered and the daughter was almost murdered. So I remember that coming up. Chuck Douglas, is Jason right? Are you thinking about ways that the death penalty should be expanded here in New Hampshire?
Yes, he is absolutely right. I believe if a racial or gender-based or religious-based murder occurs, something that we really weren't thinking much about 20, 30 years ago, certainly not in 1974 when we were drafting the death penalty, the Dylann Roofs of this world should, in my opinion, pay the ultimate price for what he did to a phenomenal, well-known historic black church. I think that type of conduct, blowing up a church, blowing up a mosque, killing 20 or 30 people, just saying, oh, well, we'll pay to have you watch TV and get fed in prison till you die, is not enough.
So racially based crimes, hate crimes, are you also maybe extending that, Chuck, to mass murder? Although a lot of these mass shooters end up killing themselves, but in some instances,
I've talked about it in the past, but I certainly think that if you are against hate crimes, as we are, and they are in our statute as a enhancement for a sentence, but death results for those who the hate crime murderer is judge, jury, and executioner, that person should pay the ultimate price because that is society's way. And I would just say to the Council of Churches, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. This is Caesar's law. This is not a theological debate.
Well, Jason, thank you for the call. And I can't believe it, gentlemen. We have to close out here. Ethan, one last quick question for you. The governor again has said he will veto this. Do we know when?
Well, I checked in on Friday. The bill has a long process to get to the governor's desk. It's not as quick as you might think. It has to go through an enrollment committee. It has to go be signed off by both leaders of both chambers, and that can take a while. What I understand is that it won't be fast-tracked. And so advocates for repeal are using that to try to implement pressure on the governor in the coming weeks to change his mind.
Oh, interesting.
So we'll see if that happens. But it seems like he is determined. But that's going to be an ongoing thing in the next few weeks.
Okay. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. And Senator Avard, it was really good to meet you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kevin Avard, prime sponsor of the bill to repeal the death penalty. He represents District 12 in the state Senate. Chuck Douglas, good to see you. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you, Laura.
Chuck Douglas, he is a former congressman, former state Supreme Court justice. And Ethan DeWitt, thank you for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
Ethan DeWitt with the Concord Monitor. And coming up, we will turn to another major story in the news. More allegations of sexual misconduct at St. Paul's boarding school, charges that date back many decades. All that's coming up.
Because you inspire, NHPR innovates. I'm Betsy Gardella, president of NHPR. In 2015, we launched the $5 million Campaign for Innovation to accelerate investment in the local news you trust and the programs you love. Now and in the years to come, we are committed to being there for you whenever and wherever you listen. Learn more at nhprinnovation.org. And thanks.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. St. Paul's School in Concord has been trying to improve its policies regarding sexual misconduct ever since a female student went public several years ago about her rape on campus and what she felt was a general attitude at the school to look the other way. And this case also highlighted problems with how these crimes were reported. So now, after months of conversations, St. Paul's recently announced a new memorandum of understanding with Concord Police, clarifying and strengthening reporting. But then, Just a day or two later, more complaints were filed. Now, these by two older men, former students, with stories of sexual misconduct by faculty dating back many decades. For the rest of the hour today, we'll sort through these two headlines, and helping us out is NHPR's Lauren Chulgen. And Lauren, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. Let's get your questions and comments in. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, respond on Facebook or Twitter at @NHPRExchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So Lauren, let's, you know, as we used to say, push the rewind a little bit and back up. What do we know already about allegations of past sexual abuse at St. Paul School?
Sure. So this will just be a brief snapshot because, as you said, this has been going on for decades. But most recently, listeners might remember that a year ago, actually this month, St. Paul's released a report from this Boston law firm named Kastner and Edwards. And basically, the school had hired them to do an independent sexual misconduct investigation after an article had come out in the newspaper about a teacher who used to be at St. Paul's but went to St. George's and was found to have sexually abused students there. So that kind of inspired this independent investigation.
Kind of sounds like the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal where priests were moved from parish to parish.
Exactly. And so what ended up happening with the first report is that they heard allegations from students of sexual misconduct by 34 faculty and staff members over 40 years. So
wow.
From 1948 to 1988. And so they were able to substantiate claims by 13 of them at that time. And then after that came out, they heard from 40 more students. So in November, they issued another report that said that they learned about sexual misconduct from 16 faculty members, some that they had already heard about, but that five were completely new. So those two things came out. That was a big thing in the, you know, St. Paul's community. And of course, this is all against the backdrop that you mentioned of the highly publicized trial in 2015 of Owen LaBrie, who was convicted of sexual assault of another student, Jesse Proud, who you also mentioned. And lastly, there's one more thing. So the New Hampshire Attorney General launched a criminal investigation into St. Paul's last summer. And in March, they filed charges against a former teacher at St. Paul's named David Pook. And he, it turns out, went to the Derryfield School after he was fired at St. Paul's. And when he was fired from St. Paul's, it was for boundary crossing issues with students. But St. Paul's, it turns out, allegedly did not tell the Derryfield School about this. And the charges were for witness tampering and conspiracy to commit perjury. But this is kind of what came out because of those charges. So all that to say, there's been a lot going on.
It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger listening to you talk.
It just seems to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
So that brings us to the most recent allegations in a lawsuit filed just last week by two former St. Paul students who attended the school way back in the 60s and 70s. It's just heartbreaking, really, to think about these men walking around with this for a long, long, long time. The allegations are pretty disturbing, in addition to the specifics of these cases, which we'll get into, but the plaintiffs even call St. Paul's a, quote, haven for sexual predators. What do they say that backs up that pretty frightening description?
Right. So you talk a lot about it earlier about this kind of the look the other way. And I think that's a big thing for them is not only that the school, they alleged, looked the other way, but knew about it and was involved in some of these incidents. And so they argue that St. Paul's was negligent in failing to prevent the sexual abuse of its students. And that's not just these two plaintiffs. They say it, obviously, as we've discussed with these reports, has occurred for lots of students. And so they claim that this pattern of conduct, though, by the school has continued through the present. So their argument is that the administration's past and present haven't dealt with this adequately, and that's what they're alleging. So basically, the lawsuit details kind of all the psychological harm that both of these men, who are now in their 60s, say that they've dealt with because of that abuse and how it's manifested itself over the years. So one is Chester Irons, and he says that he's dealt with symptoms like nightmares and depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. And Biff Mithoffer is the other one, and he says he's had high blood pressure, sleep disturbance, anxiety. And I should also mention Chester Irons' wife is also a plaintiff, and she says that, you know, she suffered a loss of her husband's affection because of his distress from the abuse.
Sure. And tell me a little bit more about Chester Irons. He was a student in the 70s. He says he was abused by one faculty member in particular. So what happened to Mr. Irons?
So Mr. Irons' case is very similar to other allegations that have come up in reports that I mentioned earlier from Kastner and Edwards. And they center around one St. Paul's faculty member named Coolidge Mead Chapin, who was also known as Cal. He actually died in 1992. But at the time, you know, Irons describes him in the lawsuit as this really powerful figure on campus. And he was really close with some of the wealthier St. Paul's families and athletic students. students. And so he was known to bring male students, many of them athletes, over to his house and on these trips to New York City. And so the incident that Irons mentions was as a kid, he was invited as a student, you know, on one of these trips. And what ends up happening is Chapin ended up taking him and three other students to a brothel in New York City. And he ordered them to take off their clothes and engage in various sex acts with prostitutes. And Irons says at the time, you know, he didn't have any sexual experience or really any understanding of sexual acts. And so he says he was terrified, demoralized, but Chapin told him not to tell anyone.
Well, and you interviewed Mr. Irons, and he talked about, you know, just what it was like. Let's hear a little bit from that interview, Lauren. This, again, is Chester Irons describing in a little more detail what you just mentioned.
In my case, I was raped by a sadistic sexual predator, Cal Chapin. I mean, that is what one would label it today. And Chapin abused scores of young boys. I don't want to give an exact number because nobody knows. But he was there for four decades. He abused fathers and sons. He abused brothers. He abused cousins. It was a multi-generational nightmare that continued for decades.
You know, Lauren, when I hear that from Chester Irons, again, one of the plaintiffs in these allegations dating way back, I mean, multi-generational nightmare. And you just think, okay, come on. I mean, how can that go on for so long?
Well, and I, what was interesting is, so I talked to Chester yesterday. And so that, you know, naming of what happened to him or what he says happened to him, you know, that took him a really long time. And so what you hear from him today was not what was going on in his brain for a long time. And so this psychological harm that he says in the lawsuit that he dealt with over these years, you know, he says it wasn't until he was in a therapy session in September 2014 that it really hit him. He says, like a freight train, that he had this incident. It was like he repressed it. And so I think a lot of these victims go through a similar thing where it's like, this happened. They move on and they repress it. And, you know, the interesting thing about Irons is he went on to become a very, very prominent alumni. I mean, he was in charge of the Alumni Association and a member of the Board of Trustees. And so I asked him, you know, how were you able to, given what you went through, you know, how were you able to do that? And he says, well, that was because that was before I had this realization that what happened to me was so bad.
Wow. Let's hear.
What happens is the body actually protects itself in this sense. The trauma is buried. And your mind literally hides it from you in terms of you recognizing as it's anything other than a distant memory.
So again, that's Chester Irons, one of the plaintiffs, describing how even though these terrible things happened to him, and they are pretty terrible, he still was engaged and involved with the school. I mean,
oh, yeah,
now
he donated
$100,000.
Wow. He was very, very involved. And like he says, it was because, you know, through a lot of mental help, he's been able to understand that his brain repressed what he says happened to him. And it was like a distant memory. But now, as we heard originally, he's come to a place where he can name what he says happened to him.
Well, let's talk about the other plaintiff.
Sure.
Keith Biff Mithofer. He alleges that several faculty members abused him, including one who went on to become a pretty well-known member of Congress. So who was this, Lauren?
So, right. So that was Gary Studs, and he went on to be a congressman in Massachusetts, and he was a pretty prominent, well-known guy. He was the first openly gay member of Congress, but he was a teacher at St. Paul's before that. And, you know, Mithofer, he details allegations of abuse from a number of St. Paul's faculty members. And this one really stuck out to me because of the way that he's kind of been conflicted about it ever since. And basically what happened was he was invited to go out to dinner with then teacher Mr. Studs. And he was someone who Mithofer really liked and admired. And on the way back from dinner, he says that Studs pulled off on a deserted road and then placed his hands on Mithofer's crotch and said some really inappropriate things. And, you know, in the allegations in the lawsuit and also in our conversation, Mithofer says, you know, he was terrified and repelled by it, but then he also felt really conflicted about how he responded.
I remember with Mr. Studs, who I thought very highly of and in a strange way still do. And when he made his approach to me, it seemed like when I turned him down, I felt like I had let him down, kind of. I didn't feel like I had any choice because I was repelled by what was happening. But afterwards, I felt like, oh, gee, certainly I wouldn't want to get him into trouble because he's such a nice man, and I believed in his politics, and he was a cool guy, and I was very flattered that he would ask me out to dinner without anyone else. All those things. Looking back on it from here, it just astonishes me, and I can so much more easily relate to all the people who are feel powerless in these situations and don't know how to process it.
Well, and there's so much there. I mean, one, you know, he was flattered by the attention. That's what they call in the sexual predator literature, grooming your victim, picking your right victim. But what also jumps out at me from that clip, Lauren, is he says, I can relate to all these people who've come forward. That's what's inspiring about these two older gentlemen is they reference the young people have who have come forward, the young women especially, although as we're hearing now, it's not just women who get abused. They're inspired by the Chessy Prouts of the world or the young gymnasts who came
the
forward.
The gymnasts, I think, is certainly
so
one.
That's kind of an intergenerational, inspirational story.
So what's really interesting about them coming forward with these allegations is, of course, that it's also coming at this time of the Me Too movement, you know, months after this really wildly strong show of force from these gymnasts, as you mentioned, in against their trainer, Larry Nassar. All kind of similar power dynamics. And
exactly.
I know Mr. Mithofer talks a lot about that and feeling the need to, you know, while watching those people, if they're able to do it, then so should he. And what really pushed him over the edge to file the lawsuit, he says, was a young woman who he's really close to was molested and threatened. And he really wanted her to report it. And he said he would support her in whatever she did. But he really internally realized, I want her to report that, which kind of caused some self-reflection.
But then I started to think, yeah, that's great, except I'm not coming forward. If a 67-year-old, middle-class, Northeasterner can't have the courage to step forward and stand next to these women and these young people and the other abusers, whether they're at St. Paul's or wherever they are, who's going to stand next to them? And it's not fun. You know, it's not fun having my name in things like this. But if I don't do it, who's going to do it? And if I don't have the courage to do it, then shame on me.
Well, and again, that's Bit Mithofer talking about his decision to sue St. Paul's based on sexual abuse that he says happened decades and decades ago. So where does this lawsuit go from here, Lauren?
Right.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. So this is currently, I mean, presently the only lawsuit of this kind against the school. And I believe it's the second lawsuit about sexual misconduct. So including the Prout family had sued and now settled with St. Paul's. And now this one, and it's very early stages. So, you know, it's been filed, hasn't been officially served on St. Paul's. That'll take a couple days. You know, they'll have to answer. So we're really in the beginning stages. But I will say that the law firm that's representing both Mr. Mithofer and Mr. Irons, they say that already four former students have reached out to them. Now, that doesn't mean it will automatically be a lawsuit, but it is interesting. You know, experts often say that when these things come out publicly, people who have also felt that, you know, might be inspired to make a call. It's also the reason why, you know, after we had the first Kastner and Edwards report, like I said, 40 more students responded afterward and said, you know, that happened to me as well.
Well, I got an email, Lauren, that came in from someone who did not want to give his or her name. This person says, my child is enrolled to attend the highly regarded summer ASP program at St. Paul's, which will cost us thousands of dollars. While we have talked as a family about the sexual assault problems they are having, I'm not really sure how to prepare my child. Should they be put in that kind of situation? Does your panel have any suggestions? Now, Lauren, you're not working at St. Paul's,
no,
or you're
but
not
I actually
an expert
did
in this
do,
field, but yeah.
I did do a story about this, about the
summer
ASP program.
The summer program is very highly regarded. If you get in, woo, I remember when I was at Keene High, which I was not in it, but those who were in it was
I
a big deal.
I also remember at Pinkerton Academy, I was not in it, but I remember it was quite a big deal. And in fact, I did a story about this a couple months ago. And trying to gauge what, if any, the impact would be about all this national conversation on the program. And really, it's been pretty much minimal to none. I mean, beyond this email, a lot of parents that I spoke with and students said, it's so different. It's a different culture, and it's just a summer, and it's such a good program and does so much for kids' futures that the cost-benefit analysis, so to speak, it just didn't really weigh. And so what I would say is I know that I've talked to administrators of the program, and they have, you know, pamphlets and information where they talk about this stuff immediately. And so I'm sure it would be addressed by those administrators.
Well, on that note, we should cover very quickly, Lauren, because we're almost out of time, that just before this latest lawsuit was filed, St. Paul's was in the news for making an agreement with the Concord Police Department over how it should report sexual assault, this MOU, Memorandum of Understanding. So really trying to strengthen and clarify reporting procedures there.
Yeah, and I also want to add before we go to that, the response from St. Paul's about these two lawsuits was that their stories, these stories from Mr. Midhoffer and Mr. Irons, are terrible. And quote, we are truly sorry for the pain they experience and for any failure of the school to protect them. So I just wanted to share that was their side of this in response to the lawsuits. Now, on the police memorandum of understanding, they had an agreement. I believe it was in 2012, the last time it was dealt with. And the police department, I talked to Lieutenant Ford, and he said, you know what, we just needed an update. And so now what needs to happen is from January forward, St. Paul's has to call the police first, and they have to go immediately about any suspected sexual abuse, and basically to step back, let the investigation continue, and even help, you know, cordon off areas or evidence or what have you, and not do their own investigation first.
Okay. Well, Lauren, you'll have your hands full.
Yes.
Thank you so much for helping us out.
Thank you.
NHPR's Lauren Chulgen, political reporter with our State of Democracy project. You can read the full text of the suit we talked about, by the way, on NHPR's website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.